down as one of the darkest chapters in recent history. The Syrian people are among the greatest victims of this century.
It started out with small protests. The Syrian government moved in to quell them. President Assad still held massive popularity. Protests got out of hand and soon swept the nation like homes. Terrorists filled the vacuum. But so did Russia, to save Syria. The sign says it all. More and more joined the war, like these fighters calling themselves the Shield of Aleppo. Neighborhoods fell to the terrorists. Religious monuments like the famous Umayyad Mosque not spared. Syrian troops regaining territory. Alliances had shifted, some pro-government, others against. But Daesh persisted, holding on to the stronghold in Raqqa.
And I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State.
وأنكم المجاهدين.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
Assad and Russian forces were falsely accused of killing civilians. Yet the U.S. and its allies were fueling the war. The cry of pain. The moment after a bombing. The devastation afterwards. Joining me in the studio is Omar Waqaf. He's the founder and director of Knossos, his Twitter address, @TheKnossosView. It's an organization expressing stakeholder opinion in Syria and the Middle East. Now, he's been a major contributor to the war in Syria, and he's appeared on numerous media outlets to give a realistic view of what is happening in that country. Omar Waqaf, welcome to the program. Taking a look at what has happened this 10-year anniversary of this war, it's beyond imagination the devastation that this country has experienced. And it's going to be futile for me to have you engage in what has occurred, but I'd rather have you look at what how things can be fixed, that is. I mean, Syria and Syrians, the path forward, how do you think that is achievable, do you think?
Well, I tell you what, you know, being a Syrian citizen and understanding things on the ground, the first key issue that should take place is that Syrian or Syrians agreeing that the objective of throwing out the government is not going to be realized. Once the majority of Syrians, even those who have been hopeful for the past 10 years for NATO to come, for, you know, whatever thing happens that could overthrow the current government, once they realize that this is not an achievable objective, because what we hear also is a lot of fanfare about UN Resolution 2254 and, you know, Constitutional Committee. And the way these things are viewed by this segment of Syrians is not about political, reconciliation or, you know, political realignment. It is actually being seen, or these are actually being seen, as tools to overthrow the current government. And they keep dreaming about, you know, Russia ordering Assad to go, Iran being bombed and withdrawing its troops, and, you know, having this catastrophical or apocalyptical sort of solutions. None of that is going to happen.
Okay, thank you, Omar Waqaf. We're going to have him back a little later on. Taking a look at now our next report, we know that the war has had an effect on the Syrians when it comes to their nutrition. Aside from poverty and unemployment, one of the outcomes is food insecurity. It's a consequence that is plaguing a large majority of the population there. After a decade of conflict and displacement, Syrians are facing the worst humanitarian conditions. Millions have slid into hunger in the last year alone. But that's not all. The collapse of the Syrian pound, its impact on the price of basic commodities, the fallout from the financial crisis in Lebanon, as well as large-scale displacements, all to further exacerbate the situation.
COVID-19 pandemic has made that situation worse. Some 4.5 million have sunk into hunger and food insecurity. The findings are shocking. A record 12.4 million Syrians, nearly 60% of the population, suffer from food insecurity and hunger today, double the number in the year 2018.
You have COVID, you have loss of the value of the currency itself, and then you have mass displacement. So when you put all of these things together, there is no surprise that we are seeing rising food insecurity, rising hunger, not only in the breadth, meaning lots and lots of people, but also in the depth.
The number of people who cannot survive without food assistance has doubled in 1 year, reaching 1.3 million people. Food prices have increased by more than 200% just in the last year. Some Syrians have not eaten meat and fruit for months due to the high prices.
Our next guest joining us in the studio is Derek Ford. He is a lecturer at DePauw University. According to his bio, his research and teachings are situated what he calls the nexus of educational theory and contemporary politics. Derek, welcome. Russia, Iran, and Turkey have keen interest in a united Syria to prosper. But U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, like Israel, well, they are destabilizing Syria. They're preventing economic advancement in that country. Israel bombing Syria routinely. Shouldn't this be addressed in order to eliminate this catastrophic economic devastation taking place there? Because no one is going to invest in a country that is being bombed or that is fueled with instability.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, President Joe Biden, in one of his first acts, even before he addressed the needs of the people in the United States, was to bomb Syria yet again and to claim self-defense. As if, you know, the U.S. has any right to claim self-defense in Syria, where they haven't been invited by the government, and they're there as an illegal occupying army, right, an illegal occupying force. And so they obviously give the green light to Israel for those bomb droppings, and I think that that's one of the main obstacles. That, you know, the war has to end, right? There has to come to an end. It has to come to an end. It's been going on too long. There's been way too much suffering. And the objectives that the U.S. and its allies set out to achieve haven't been attained, and they are, in fact, unattainable.
Well, what about these sanctions, such as the CSAR Act? That was like the final blow by the previous U.S. President Donald Trump before he left office. Not only do these sanctions, like the CSAR Act, worsen the existing humanitarian crisis there, well, it has deprived the Syrian people of their chance to rebuild their lives through their infrastructure rebuilding. I mean, is that the U.S. aim?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And, you know, a Lancet Medical Journal article from July of last year, I believe, noted the sanctions' immense impact on Syria recovering from COVID-19. And so I think the fact that, you know, the blockades, the sanctions are aimed really at that tells you what they're really about, you know? I mean, for one, the sanctions are for government-controlled areas, right, which is just legitimate Syrian territory, where 70% of the people live. And so they've cost, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. There's sort of runaway inflation. It's an annual, you know, it's at the highest annual inflation rate ever just because there's a scarcity of goods, scarcity of jobs, and so on and so forth. And so obviously it's part of the war, right? It's not a separate, it's a tactic in the war to try, despite 10 years of resistance and really victory, to overthrow the Syrian government.
Well, very well. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Derek Ford, lecturer at DePauw University, with his comments there. Okay, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up, so stay right where you are. It's time now to take a look at our final report, which is really a close look at the CSAR Act. Now, the previous U.S. President Donald Trump and his team were responsible for executing it. They claimed that it would target the government only, but doesn't that mean Syrians would suffer? Some argue for and against it, but take it from us here in Iran. We know U.S.'s real intentions. After all, we have been the target of U.S. sanctions.
Today, we begin a sustained campaign of sanctions against the Assad regime under the Caesar Act, named after the brave photographer who 6 years ago brought the world documented proof of the Assad regime's brutality against fellow Syrians. These targeted designations seek to deny the regime revenue and support that it uses to wage war and commit mass atrocities against the Syrian people. Today, the Assad regime and those who support it have a simple choice. Take irreversible steps towards a lasting political solution to the Syrian conflict in line with UNSCR 2254, or face ever new tranches of crippling sanctions.
Time to bring back Ammar Waqab, founder and director of Gnosos, with a Twitter hashtag at the Gnosos View, an organization that expresses stakeholder opinion in Syria and the Middle East. Okay, Ammar, welcome back. There never has been really an effort to bring down a government like in the case of Syria. So many foreign players, the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, for example. What are the U.S. aims in this country? I mean, why has it spent all this energy on this war when it could have spent that energy maybe on finding a political solution, or better yet, to push an economic solution to heal the nation so that it can move forward?
Well, basically, the U.S. aim has been, since the very start of this crisis, is to effect and gain geopolitical influence in Syria. With the current Syrian government, the way it is aligned, either with Iran or Russia or whatever, basically anti-Israeli interest in the region, that was not going to happen, so the only way to do it is to bring it down. That's option number one, and bring another or a replacement government or a political body that could adhere to such interests, or B, force it to change its course of action, basically by starving its, to death. And this is what's happening, because the first objective didn't happen. They couldn't do it. There were enough Syrians whose interests really laid in keeping the government on its feet. They sent their children to military. They suffered a lot. And now they're suffering very much. So the next possible thing for the American policy is to force the current Syrian government to compromise with its needs in the region. What is really happening is that the Syrian people are really suffering. We need to understand also that the United States isn't only effecting sanctions that are suffocating Syria, they are also preventing Syrian people from benefiting from their own resources like wheat, water, electricity from the Euphrates, and most significantly oil. And now when Syrians need to import oil, their tankers are being targeted and everything. So all in all, there is a double action to suffocate the Syrian state, and this, my opinion, inadvertently is actually pushing Syria more towards the strengthening the alliance with Iran and Russia.
All right,
and
very
China,
well.
Of course.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate Ammar Waqab, founder and director of Gnosos, there with his comments. Right now it's time to take a look at one of the worst affected and perhaps the most traumatized segments of the Syrian society, namely children. Hundreds and thousands of them have lost their parents to this war. One shocking figure: nearly 5 million children were born inside Syria over the past 10 years. But the following faces tell a story of pain and wounded hearts. In that section, we are going to take a look at Syria's war, but in numbers. We figured that's the best thing to do. 10 years of war, upending the lives of millions of Syrians, a natural outcome of this war. The economy, as a result, it has pummeled. And along with that key infrastructure, it has been ravished. Here are some of the numbers. First, the human cost, 450,000 dead. In terms of the people who have fled this war, 4.5 million. And the people who are missing, it is recorded to be roughly around 200,000 people. Next comes one of the darkest chapters of this war. Instances of chemical weapons usage. 38 have been recorded. And in one attack, only 1,400 were killed. The world blaming Assad. But it turned out that the terrorists had actually staged many of those attacks, if not all. Now the economy, ravaged to the tune of $1.2 trillion over the course of 10 years. $91.5 billion lost revenue from hydrocarbons, and 98% the devaluation of the Syrian pound to the dollar on the black market. In terms of food prices, 33 times higher across the country. Taking a look at the children who are facing hunger, 60% of the population of children. And in terms of poverty, you're looking at 2 million people. Now, our final look at the numbers comes to infrastructure. Energy grids in that country, 70% are out of order. Hospitals, only 58% are functional. And when it comes to schools, in terms of operational capability of them, 33% are in ruins, which leaves roughly about 67% that are working. When it comes to the war on Syria, it appears that it has faded from the headlines. I said that in the beginning of the program, but it shouldn't. For starters, Israel is bombing that country over and over again. Another country that is occupying it, namely the U.S., well, it's stealing its resources, namely oil, which the revenues could go to the desperate people of Syria. But there's another reason why Syria should not fade from the headlines. It should serve as a reminder that the U.S. push for regime changes and the redrawing of the map of West Asia or the Middle East has failed. Meanwhile, there's another path to changing the dynamics of the region, and that is economically. For where there's economic prosperity and trade between countries, there are less tensions and chances for war. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. From Mikhail Tavai and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amoli. Stay tuned.
شیطان رجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. رخداد تلخی که اخیراً جامعه بشری را
I seek refuge with Allah from Satan, the outcast. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. The bitter events which have lately engulfed humanity, that is, the uninvited coronavirus disease, is in accordance with the absolute mercy of Allah.
ممکن نیست دعا مستجاب نشود. اولا از جامعه گرانقدر با فضیلت جامعه پزشکی حق شناسی میکنی.
This isn't possible that a dua or supplication doesn't get answered. We must realize that the value of the highly valued and virtuous society of physicians, and we request the exalted being of Allah to include all of them in his special divine mercy. The foremost group which must do dua are the esteemed physicians and nurses by supplicating, O Allah, endow us with knowledge to cure this disease. Endow us with discovering the cure to this disease. Endow us with discovering the medicine for this disease. Endow us with discovering the path to health. These are some of the important supplications which the doctors and nurses can recite, and after the recitation, ask for two things: the ways of removing this disease and the ways of resolving this disease.
امیدواریم ذات اقدس اله نزای ما را جامعه ما را مخصوصا بزرگوار و بزرگان پزشکی ما را که در خط مقدم
We are hopeful that the exalted being of Allah protects our Islamic system, our society, and especially the greatly esteemed physicians who are on the front line of this danger, protects them from all harms and removes this disease and virus from humanity. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amoli. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
About you, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Evidence that a variant of the coronavirus identified in South Africa might compromise immunity sparks concerns about vaccine effectiveness, says Evan Calloway, researcher, in an article published under the heading, Fast-spreading COVID variant can elude immune responses. Stay tuned for the details, please. Evidence is growing that some coronavirus variants could evade immune responses triggered by vaccines and previous infections. Researchers are trying to make sense of a tsunami of lab studies released recently that raise concerns about some emerging variants and mutations. Some of the data I've seen in the last 48 hours have really scared me, says Daniel Altman, an immunologist at Imperial College London, who worries that some of the results could portend a reduction in the effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines. But the picture is murky, Altman and other scientists emphasize. The studies, which examined the blood of a small numbers of people who had recovered from COVID-19 or received a vaccine, probed only their antibodies' capacity to neutralize variants in lab tests, and not the wider effects of other components of their immune response. Neither do the studies indicate whether the changes in antibody activity make any difference to the real-world effectiveness of vaccines or the likelihood of reinfection. Are these changes going to be important? I really don't know, says Paul Business, a virologist at Rockefeller University in New York City, who co-led one of the studies. Much of the concern centers around the variant that researchers identified in South Africa in late 2020. A team led by Tulio do Oliveira, a bioinformatician at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa, linked the variant called 501Y.V2 to a fast-growing epidemic in Eastern Cape Province that has since spread across South Africa and into other countries. The lineage carries many mutations in the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, the immune system's prime target, which allows the virus to identify and infect host cells, including some changes linked to weakened antibody activity against the virus. The Eastern Cape was hit hard by South Africa's first COVID-19 wave, and researchers wondered whether the rapid spread of 501Y.V2 could be partly explained by its ability to elude previously established immune responses. To investigate this, Joe Oliveira, virologist Alex Sigal at the Africa Health Research Institute in Durban, and other colleagues isolated 501Y.V2 viruses from people infected with the variant.
They then tested the variant samples against cerium. The antibody-containing portion of blood taken from six people who had recovered from COVID-19 caused by other versions of the virus. This convalescent cerium tends to contain neutralizing or virus-blocking antibodies that can prevent infection. The researchers found that the convalescent cerium was much worse at neutralizing 501Y.V2 than at neutralizing variants that circulated earlier in the pandemic. Some people's plasma performed better against 501Y.V2 than did others, but in all cases, the neutralizing power was substantially weakened. It's extremely worrying. In a separate study, a team led by virologist Penny Moore at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases and the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, probed the effects of convalescent cerium on various combinations of spike mutations found in 501Y.V2. They did this using a pseudovirus, a modified form of HIV that infects cells using the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. These experiments showed that 501Y.V2 contains mutations that blunt the effects of neutralizing antibodies that recognize two key regions of a spike, its receptor binding and N-terminal domains. Pseudoviruses with the full package of 501Y.V2 mutations were fully resistant to convalescent cerium from 21 out of 44 participants, and were partly resistant to the vast majority of people's sera, Moore's team found. There is now proof of several reinfections with 501Y.V2 in South Africa, says Do Oliveira. It seems increasingly likely that the variant's ability to spread in places hit hard by earlier waves of COVID-19 is being driven, in part, by its capacity to evade immune responses that developed in response to earlier versions of the virus. It becomes virtually inescapable that that's what's happening, says Benzes, noting that variants identified in Brazil and the United Kingdom carry some of the same spike mutations. Both South African teams will soon test the 501Y.V2 variant with cerium from people who participated in COVID-19 vaccine trials, and similar studies are underway at labs worldwide. A team co-led by Benzes found that mutations in the receptor binding domain of 501Y.V2 caused a modest drop in the potency of antibodies from people who had received either vaccines of Pfizer or Moderna. That's a reassuring finding, says Moore, but it will be important to test the consequences of other mutations in 501Y.V2. Whether these could lessen the effectiveness of vaccines is still uncertain, says Volker Thiel, an RNA virologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. Most COVID-19 vaccines elicit high levels of antibodies that target diverse regions of the spike protein. So, some of the molecules are likely to be able to block variants of the virus. And other components of the immune response, such as T cells, might not be affected by 501Y.V2. Although the vaccines target only the spike gene, they should still mount an immune response that is diverse enough that these new variants should be covered. Thiel says, what experimental studies need to be done? Data from ongoing efficacy trials and national vaccine rollouts should be able to uncover the effects of the variants. Several vaccines are still being trialed in South Africa, and researchers will be watching for any drop in their ability to prevent COVID-19 that's linked to the rise of 501Y.V2. A dampened antibody response to variants such as 501Y.V2 might not be much of a problem in practice, says Marian Koopmans, a virologist at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, the Netherlands. You can see some change in a lab assay, which does not have an effect in a person because that person still has enough antibodies to neutralize the infection. It can also be difficult to disentangle whether reinfections are due to waning immune responses triggered by the first infection or to the effects of a mutation, she adds. Clues are also beginning to emerge about the behavior of a fast-spreading variant identified in the United Kingdom known as B117. In pseudovirus experiments, researchers at biotech firm BioNTech in Mainz, Germany found that B117's spike mutations had little effect on sera from 16 people who had received the vaccine. Meanwhile, a team led by virologist Ravindra Gupta at the University of Cambridge, UK, looked at the sera of 15 people who had received the first of two doses of the same immunization. The team found that 10 people's sera was less effective against B117 than against other versions of SARS-CoV-2. These changes shouldn't make a difference to the vaccine's effectiveness now, says Gupta, but they could as antibody levels wane over time. What this week's results mean for battling the pandemic are not yet clear. It is a top priority for researchers to determine whether mutations in 501Y.V2 are responsible for reinfections. If they are, says Do Oliveira, the whole idea of herd immunity would become a pipe dream, at least from natural infection.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamati.
Islamati.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all our brothers and sisters, our dear good listeners. You're listening to Youth Station only on IRIB English Radio. I'm Hassanain, and we have in our studio with us Sister Zainab.
Salaamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, or other life forms, welcome to Youth Station.
How are you, Sister Zainab?
I'm good.
Sister Zainab, nowadays, you know, all the people, you know, everyone's behind becoming rich. They all want to be rich. What about you? Are you rich? Like, what do you think of yourself? Where do you put yourself in the category of the rich people, or what do you think?
Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, I would put myself in the category of being the rich.
MashaAllah.
I had nothing to do with it, though. But I think I need to explore that question of yours a bit.
Okay, now, when I ask you, like, are you rich? So, like, rich as in, what do you think of, like, rich as
okay.
in money?
Okay, yeah, let's start with our definition of rich.
Now, when
first.
You said that you're rich, what did you mean by that?
I personally think I'm rich in every aspect or in most...
What do you mean by every aspect? So, you mean to say that rich is not just by money?
See...
Not just by wealth?
Dictionary definition of rich is, number one, having a great deal of money or assets.
Uh-huh.
Synonym, wealthy.
Which you have a lot?
Yes. Number two, existing in plentiful quantities, abundant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So obviously there are two aspects to being rich. It's either money wealthy,
mm-hmm.
right? You have abundant money and you're rich.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's great. That's dangerous, though, I feel. Because...
Why is it dangerous?
Because Day of Judgment happens and Allah questions you for every single dime and penny you earned mm-hmm. and you spent.
Yeah, like what way did you spend it?
Exactly. How did you earn it and how did you spend it? Why did you spend it like that? Yeah. You know, they...
Like as we say that hasa will be
exactly.
longer. Yeah.
Exactly. And they will be delayed before the gates of heaven if mm-hmm. they end up in heaven.
Okay,
right?
Now let me ask you, like, what are the different types of, you know, aspects of being rich? What do
and
you
then
think?
There's the other aspect of having been wealthy in other assets. Asset doesn't necessarily have mm-hmm. to be monetary.
Yeah.
Right? I can be rich in friends, which I consider myself to be very mm-hmm. much. I have like a few friends that mm-hmm. I can legit go to their door in the middle of the night, tell them that I committed murder.
Uh-huh.
They're going to be like, let me get my shovel and my car keys. Uh-huh. No questions asked.
Uh-huh.
All right.
So you've got some good friends.
Some
yeah.
very good, very trustworthy, very loyal friends. I am rich in the love that I receive.
Like partner in crime.
My partners in crime.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I think I'm very rich and wealthy in terms of the love I receive and I give out.
Okay, so that's good. That's really good. So we have the idea of different aspects of being rich. So anyone can be rich by the wealth.
Yeah.
And some people might be rich by the character.
Mm.
And some people also might be rich, you know, in terms of spirituality.
Absolutely.
So let's go on with the second one. What do you think by being rich by the character?
Rich in character, I think... Okay, that I might not be because I'm very socially awkward. I'm socially awkward. I'm an introvert. I don't know how to socialize. I don't know how to make small talk. But for people who I've seen that are rich in character, in personality,
yeah.
they're charismatic, they're well-spoken, they carry themselves very well, they're
right.
intelligent. I mean, talking about these things, one
basically
would
know how to carry themselves, like,
yeah.
you know, in the society.
One would attribute these qualities to someone who's rich in money, too. Have you seen most people who are filthy
rich? So they're
rich,
almost, like, connected.
I don't know whether it's the money that makes a person interesting or whether they were interesting, so interesting that they became rich. Because, like, when we talk rich, money rich, who's the first person that comes to your mind?
Bill Gates.
Really? I was thinking Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne is assumed to be richer than Bill Gates, right?
Nah,
I don't know. I have to look it up.
It's Jeff, the richest
Jeff Bezos?
Guy in the world. Yeah.
I don't like Jeff Bezos. I don't even find him charismatic or interesting. But Bruce Wayne was
You don't
very
like Jeff Bezos, but you still use Amazon. Okay, so when we say that someone is not rich.
Yeah.
So do we mean like they don't have money, that they're financially challenged?
Oh my God, Bill Gates is actually richer than Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne's net worth is $9.2 billion.
Total, yeah.
And Bill Gates' net worth officially of 13th January 2021.
Okay, why are they so rich? Why are they so rich?
Because they were stinking geniuses.
Okay, so you mean to say that the people who are not rich, they're not smart
enough to be that rich. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bruce Wayne was a genius. Bill Gates is a genius. Who else? Elon Musk is a genius.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I think it has a lot to do with time and era as well, because there were geniuses before the world wars.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they couldn't necessarily make a lot of money out of their intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Or even now, do we have Nobel Prize winners for physics, math, and peace, and this, and for literature, and this, and that.
Yeah.
But they aren't necessarily filthy rich off of that, you know, the genius that they have. But then we have authors like J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
She is a genius,
yeah.
Right? She is an imaginative, creative genius in literature. And she became a cajillionaire.
So, like, being rich, does it depend upon someone's intelligence?
I think so, yes, because we even have a hadith.
No, like, if you say that, then it means that, you know, all the people who are not rich,
yeah.
Like, not necessarily them being poor, but, you know, them being not rich, like middle-class people.
Mm.
So does it mean that they're not smart?
No. I'm saying that 90% of rich people, unless they were born into the money,
uh-huh.
Right? They were like someone like, I don't know, Donald Trump. I wouldn't consider him as a genius, right? But he was rich anyway because mostly he was born into the money.
Okay, do you think that being rich is good?
But let me just clarify this.
Uh-huh.
90% of people who are self-established, self-made billionaires are geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
They were smart enough to make themselves into billionaires, right?
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't mean that whoever's
not rich,
whoever's intelligent has to become rich. But whoever becomes rich has to be intelligent.
That's not necessary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So there could be middle class people who are really intelligent and smart.
Mm-hmm.
They either never had the drive, you know, they weren't money minded.
Yeah.
They never had the drive or the reason to make themselves filthy rich.
Mm-hmm.
They were, I mean, their life circumstances were different.
No, but still, what I think that the many smart people out there, the many intelligent people, but they don't get chance, you know.
There's also that.
Yeah,
exactly.
there might be any of their personal issues, personal problems. They they're smart, but they couldn't go to the university. They couldn't get the admission in the university.
Mm.
So that's the reason that they stay behind.
Mm.
So it's all about the, you know, time, you know. So.
Or maybe they just never cared to get rich. I can't imagine someone like Nikola Tesla caring. He was a filthy genius, right? It was his innovative theories that made so many inventions that we have today, including the many of the means through someone like Elon Musk earned his fortune possible. Nikola Tesla died in absolute poverty. He died alone, he died poor, but he was a stinking genius.
Yeah.
And I think the reason was that he didn't care to, like, make himself rich or known or achieve materialistic.
Okay, so what do you think that being rich, is it good? Is it good being rich?
Depends.
You know, I guess there's one of these ayats in the Holy Quran. You know, when people get rich, like, not exactly rich, you know, when people feel that they're not dependent on anything, that, you know, they get far away from Allah
subhanahu
wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
So they don't feel any, you know, need for God. Mm. They don't need feel any need.
Yeah, yeah. They
so
become arrogant.
Yeah, exactly. They become arrogant. So sometimes, you know, being rich has also some drawbacks.
Mm.
You know, every
Absolutely.
Coin has two sides. You know, being rich is, being rich itself, it's a good thing.
Is it though?
Yeah, it's a good thing itself. Like, being rich, you can, it has got consequences.
Yeah.
So.
And that's the thing, whether the consequences are worth it or not, you know?
Yeah, like, if someone's rich, you know, being rich, he can help the poor people.
Exactly. That's why I said it depends.
Yeah.
Depends on the goal he has behind becoming rich.
Yeah.
And how he spends his wealth. How,
like,
he
some people are rich, but they're selfish.
Mm.
That don't help the needy, you know. So, you know, as people get their wealth, you know, they get farther away from Allah.
And another thing, I think there's a certain standard, an average for being rich. And if you exceed that,
what do you mean by that?
I'll explain. If you exceed that average of being rich, then it has not been through sound, healthy, and sometimes even lawful means.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe that certain elites in the world, that 1% that is constantly talked about, who are filthy rich, are filthy rich through corrupt means. And they've only reached that degree of wealthiness.
Yeah, that's a completely different thing. No, that's a completely different thing. You're talking about how did they become rich.
Yeah, so I'm saying that there should be a norm for rich.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
So there's the poor people in the community. But then again, if we look at it from a very Islamic, idealistic Islamic worldview, there shouldn't be that much of a gap between the different classes of a society, right? Because there shouldn't be poor people.
Like, if someone's rich, he's a good man, so he can use his wealth in the right way.
That's why we have concepts, such as zakat and hummus and this and that, you know, so that they can balance it out.
Right.
I think it's like some sort of, it's sort of like an Islamic socialism.
Mm-hmm.
That allows people to benefit from one another in a way that makes society a bit more just.
True. Let's just discuss about being rich in spirituality. What do you think about that?
Being rich in spirituality, I don't think that has anything to do with anything.
You know, you're rich in spirituality like when you purify yourself, when you're closer to Allah.
Exactly.
So that's why it's not by money. It's by it depends upon your, you know, your closest to Allah.
But still, it has to a great extent. It needs a lot of determination, just like being money rich.
No, yeah, but exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
You have to work a lot upon ourselves. Exactly. That we need to purify ourselves.
Absolutely.
We need to get closer to Allah Subhanahu wa Taala. We need to follow every of his command.
Mm, exactly.
So.
And at the end of the day, that's the most valuable form of wealth.
Yeah.
You know, because when you're rich spiritually, you're set in this world and the hereafter.
You know, the wealth we're talking about, the materialistic world that you get by money, you can have this materialistic world.
Mm.
But it's just only in this dunya. But what about the hereafter?
Exactly.
What helps is being rich in your spirituality.
Mm.
You being close to Allah and you being like, you purifying yourself, you being pure. So we're running out of time, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us, and thank you so much, Sister Zaina. And I pray that inshallah we all be rich in both this world and the hereafter. Thank you so much. Until the next show, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.